All right, welcome back to the Crimson Flag Podcast, where we bring you a class-conscious analysis of historic and current events that is pertinent to the international working class movement. All right, my name is FVK, and we have Danky King here. And Today we're going to do another one of our current event-style episodes. You know, we decided to switch it up a little bit. How we're going to do this one is we're going to do it more of a reaction style to some things that we've seen in the news from the last month. We're going to have two major topics that we kind of like focus on. And our first one, we're going to talk a little bit about the crisis in Xinjiang and an ex-FBI whistleblower who actually pretty much predicted this back in 2015. And then after that, we'll talk a little bit about some of AOC's recent comments, which, you know, a lot of people have been talking about. So we got to kind of at least cover it here at least once or twice to, you know, join in this.
I can't wait. Can't wait to see what brilliant glimmers of wisdom AOC is going to give us.
So like the background, like why this 2015 video is resurfacing again here is because China's foreign ministry spokesperson, that's Zhao Lijian, he claimed on the 14th of April that the U.S. government had been aware or complicit in the arming of terrorists in Xinjiang. And what he references to this is he shows a video from this podcast that we're about to watch here. And I want to stress again, it's in 2015 because at times it sounds really relevant to right now. And the person speaking in this video is a former FBI contract translator. And her name is Sibel Edmonds. And apparently she was hired right after 9/11 and she left after 7 months. But I had to look it up actually to learn a little bit about her, but I guess her deal is that she has basically exposed since how the FBI was very incompetent in their translation division and how some terrorist attacks even crept by because people weren't well-versed enough in the language that they were supposed to know. So, but this is her surprisingly talking about Xinjiang. So yeah, if you want to kick that off here, Danky.
Sure.
Important in terms of this Gladio B narrative, which you've been laying out for a number of years now. And this one comes via the New York Times, January 14th, 2015. Turks are held in plot to help Uyghurs leave China. And this is talking about 10 Turkish citizens and 2 Chinese citizens that have been arrested and accused of providing altered Turkish passports to terrorist suspects from the western region of Xinjiang, a state-run newspaper reported on Wednesday. Xinjiang, that sounds familiar.
People who have been following my interviews, if they recall, even in 2004, 2005, I always talked about the importance of Xinjiang and what Turkey and U.S. like to refer to as East Turkestan, the Xinjiang region, in this operation to organize the descent of Uyghurs against the mainland China and the Chinese government. I used to talk about this a lot, and people would say, why? I mean, she's talking about Xinjiang, Turkestan. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia. Why can't we talk about Pakistan? They are relevant. Who cares what's happening in the place called Xinjiang? We don't even know how it's spelled. A lot of these people are taken out by Gladio operatives, in this case, most of the times by the Turks. They are trained and they are armed and then they are sent back. And there are various areas, porous borders. And even if you look at Afghanistan, especially now that we have Afghanistan as a kind of a base, you can see how easy it is to smuggle these people out, militaristically train them and arm them, tell them what to do in terms of the next stage of operations, then send them back from the other side, going through Central Asian Caucasus to Afghanistan, where lo and behold, some terror events takes place and people have no idea. How did they get the guns, you know? How were they trained militaristically? Because Xinjiang is under China's control. Well, they are trained outside, similar to with the Syrian opposition. So the Chinese government's version of the story is much closer than when the New York Times takes the version of the Turkish side. It's going to be extremely important, this region. Xinjiang is going to be the next Taiwan. Look at the map. You see the importance of Xinjiang. That is the entry artery of energy, whether it's coming from Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan into China, whether it's natural gas or if it's oil, it has to pass. As long as the Gladio, United States, the CIA, the NATO, they control that region with the terrorism, can you imagine any pipeline safely going through Xinjiang area and get into the heart of the mainland China? It's not going to happen. That's why it's very important. And then it's going to come to the point where we're going to have someone similar to Richard Gere start giving speeches and talk about, like they do it with the monks there in Tibet, how these people are being abused and oppressed and they need to have their own land.
There's an ethnic group in China being systematically surveilled and imprisoned in an attempt to essentially wipe their culture off the map. That is heartbreaking and completely indefensible.
And as we talked about before, the United States have already brought one of these figures from Xinjiang area into the United States. He lives in McLean, into the State Department. And they had a meeting where they declared him the president of East Turkestan in absentia. So as far as the Gladio U.S. is concerned, they even have a president for Xinjiang. How could you have a president for a country, nation that doesn't exist? There's no sovereignty. It's part of mainland China. Meaning that is the objective. We want another Taiwan.
You raise a number of important points there. This might not be the new Taiwan. It might be the new Tibet, the kind of trendy Hollywood cause célèbre that everyone has to get behind when George Clooney or whoever CFR member comes out and speaks out about it. I think the other important point that you raise there is there are genuine issues about the way the Han Chinese treat the Uyghur population and the types of anti-terror operations that the Chinese conduct in these regions. But it's always a question of what then is the solution and how does it play out and for whose interests. The same way that Ukraine became a flashpoint and a focal point for the new Cold War with Russia, I think something like Xinjiang could become a flashpoint for what's going to happen
it's
with China.
It's definitely going to come. The question is not whether it's going to come. The question is when. And you see that gradually they are paving the way. So it's going to happen, whether it's 5 years down the road or 2 years down the road. And these things heating up. And of course, Chinese are playing it very, very smart. Very smart. When I keep looking at how they respond things, how they handle it, they are so logical. Have we ever heard China really loudly saying the United States is doing this? They know they have a very, very good counterintelligence, but it will be hard for the Western powers to try to throw the bait and say, okay, bite it, bite it. So even though they are doing the counterterror, they are doing it in a very self-controlled, restrained manners because they know what the game is about. It's going to be extremely important, this region. Xinjiang is going to be the next Taiwan. Look at the map. You see the importance of Xinjiang. That is the entry artery of energy, whether it's coming from Kazakhstan or Turkmenistan into China, whether it's natural gas or if it's oil, it has to pass.
Yeah, I mean, so the general claim for those of you who have been living under a rock is that China is committing this ethnic cleansing, this genocide of the Uyghur people in Xinjiang province. And these claims have been repeatedly and thoroughly debunked, but they always come from far-right Western-backed media sources. Just the other day, there was an article from the Senkai Shimbun, the far-right Japanese fascist newspaper, that was shared and treated as a valid source by Western media. I believe it was the New York Times. And so there are all of these examples of the Western media taking the bait and using Xinjiang as this flashpoint, much like the FBI translator, the ex-FBI translator said, how Ukraine was used as a flashpoint for tensions in this new Cold War with Russia. Xinjiang is being used as a flashpoint, and I know you and I have talked about how Xinjiang is the modern day Tibet, is the modern day version of this Tibet movement. And I've personally seen throughout the Western left how the Free Tibet movement has prevailed throughout, especially anarchist circles, social democrat circles, progressive circles. And so in much the same way that Tibet and the Free Tibet movement became a focal point for the American left, I feel like this Liberate the Uyghurs in Xinjiang movement is going to be sort of the focal point for the American left now.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, of course, one of the biggest things that stands out about this video is that, you know, when you talk about political predictions, there's various ways you can look at it. I'd feel confident saying that this is pretty much a straight up political prediction. But yeah, she does point that out, that like she says, people like Richard Gere, you know, might be jumping on and start. And we've seen that. But that is one thing that she doesn't say specifically, you know, what you're pointing about the left getting wrapped up in all this, the new left, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And we were talking a little bit about before about like Democracy Now and how some of these outlets even got duped. And so it's interesting to see how far it spread just because of the human rights side of the narrative. You know, I guess like what they start out with to base this whole thing is they talk about an article. It was in the New York Times in 2014, and it's talking about how Turks are helping terrorist suspects leave Xinjiang. And as they're claiming, you know, these people are being trained outside. Of course, it couldn't be done inside China. So they're saying this is an example of documentation of this. Where they, you know, now here, where are they talking about? Because like I said before, the Chinese foreign minister, he was talking about how the U.S. was aware or complicit in these actions. And the FBI translator we were just listening to, you know, she's saying, I think her claim is pretty much, it's clear that America knew that something like this was going on, if not putting their hands in it, because, it, you know, we're getting these little tidbits of information, even from the New York Times, just here and there. So this isn't right. Totally just like nobody knows about it kind of thing. You know, and sometimes these things are in plain sight.
And like, this wouldn't be the first time the United States has recruited Islamic radicals in those regions, like Mujahideen fighters in the Soviet-Afghan War. They armed the forces known as Al-Nusra Front, which later became Al-Qaeda. And they also armed some of the earliest forces behind the Taliban. So as far as the United States, like stoking regional conflict or a tribal conflict in the area to suit their own geopolitical purposes, like that, there is a historical precedent for that already established. And it's like you and I were talking the other night off the air about how America wants to control Xinjiang because it is a natural corridor into China, and also because it's part of a wider encirclement strategy. The United States already has substantial military forces along Afghanistan, and they also need this region, this Xinjiang region, to crumble and fall as well. So I feel like the United States isn't planning on taking out China in a direct invasion, because that would obviously be disastrous. And so what they want to do is try to carve it up into little pieces. They want to break off Xinjiang. They want to break off Hong Kong, and they want to support Taiwan and Tibet and other like secessionist movements within China. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like this prediction was pretty much spot on, because as her friends were, you know, chastising her, why don't you talk about Saudi Arabia? Why don't you focus on them? She was rightly placing her focus on Xinjiang, which was going to become like the focal point of all of this. And the thing that really makes me wonder about all of this is that this was predicted back in 2015. Now it's 2021, you know, 6 years later, we see all of this has pretty much come to fruition.
Right, right. Yeah, there's a couple of points, you know, about that. In their interview, there was a point where they were talking about Gladio-like fighters or something, and I had to look that up. And apparently Operation Gladio was, it was like a CIA operation of some sort, where they were training rebels from like socialist countries, but they're training them outside of their respective countries for the hopes that one day they might go in and like stir up a revolution or something. I actually like was just learning about this, so I don't know too much about it, but it's a long-term strategy in that regard. But it's also a long-term strategy in the regard that, I guess, you know, when we talk about like the Vietnam War, a lot of what they were talking about behind the scenes, like the generals and stuff, and well, maybe not the generals involved, but like the politicians involved, it was to keep China from spreading its influence. They were worried. I was surprised to read that, because I thought they would be more concerned about like the Soviet Union spreading its influence. But they were actually more concerned about like these Asian countries all like, you know, uniting together into like a socialist bloc of some sort. But just one last point on what you were saying, and they were talking about, is this being a flashpoint. You know, I guess that's why this is important, because a lot of people talk about, it is important to talk about, you know, what is China doing around the world right now? That's a little bit outside of the scope of this conversation, you know, regarding the Belt and Road and everything. But with regard to Xinjiang, I would say that, you know, this is just an area where we should give them solidarity, you know, because these are international agreements that, you know, they've agreed with other countries to trade through the area. And it's pretty much just being stopped by, like, force by another rival, by a rival imperialist country. So just from that aspect, I think we should have solidarity around it, them with this issue. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be, you know, broader discussions on their role in the world, because we're all going to have our varied opinions on that.
Right. And we've pointed out in the past how various Islamic countries have come out and said, you know, we agree with how the Chinese government is treating the Uyghur population, and we don't see any genocide happening here. So all of the claims of genocide are coming from the most biased sources imaginable. And, you know, to me, the damning evidence is to see China's other geopolitical rivals not saying, yes, they are doing a genocide. Because, you know, I don't want to name any names, but, you know, you take a country like Vietnam, who has a geopolitical rivalry with China, you know, it would be very easy for them to jump on board with that kind of thing, and yet they're not saying it, and no other Muslim country is saying it either. So it's very strange to me to see how, like, no one can really see the clear bias at play here. Most people, when they cite these sources talking about a Xinjiang genocide, are citing someone funded by the CIA or by the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation or some far-right fringe crazy fascist newspaper somewhere, and it's absurd.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is amazing, because on one hand it's so easy to bust open, but it's so hard to get people to do that kind of work. You know, it's not just like presented right to them, so it just slips right by so many folks. But, you know, regarding this whole issue, we haven't actually commented on this yet publicly too much, I don't think, as far as this show goes. But there are obviously a lot of other channels that are covering this, like, super in depth. You know, The Gray Zone comes to mind. I know Daniel Dumbrill and Nathan Rich or some. But there's a lot of people covering this. But I definitely want to just give a little more attention to that video, because sometimes we can even forget about these things, you know, no matter how crazy some of this evidence is. But yeah, with that, I think we can definitely transition into our next little segment here. Yeah, so, you know, this is a comment that AOC gave recently in a podcast or a meeting of some sort. I guess it's saying a Zoom town hall. But, you know, the Twitter user here, Human Rights Watch Watcher, if you have not heard, actually got in trouble with the police for a comment that he made about AOC on Twitter. And, you know, Human Rights Watch Watchers claims, you know, I didn't make any violent comments against AOC or anything. I was merely just criticizing something that she said about the Israel and Palestine issue. And nonetheless, the police showed up at this Twitter user's door, and he has been vocal on, I believe The Gray Zone did interview him. So that was interesting. But here he is posting another video of AOC, no matter, you know, nonetheless of his experience with the police. So, yeah, let's see what AOC has to say.
Yeah, it's funny that AOC wants the little guy to stand up to big government, except when they start doing that to her, all of a sudden, like, he must be silenced. The hypocrisies that come from AOC are endless, and she represents what Bernie Sanders would have done if he would have become the president of the United States. He would have just sold out and catered to the Democratic establishment. You know, not to go off on a tangent here, but any notion that these progressive politicians can come into this highly corrupt Democratic Party and somehow change it for the better, or change it to represent more of a social democratic front, is laughable. The political capital for it just isn't there. They're going to be absorbed into the greater slime that is the Democratic Party establishment. So let's hear what the very progressive, totally not a sellout, AOC has to say.
I mean, one thing that I will say is that I do think that the Biden administration and President Biden has definitely exceeded expectations that progressives had. You know, I'll be frank. I think a lot of us expected a much more conservative administration. And I think that his, not only what has ultimately come out, but the active invitation and willingness and collaboration with progressives in his first 100 days, or almost 100 days, has been very impressive. And so while there are very, you know, there are areas where there are just plain areas of disagreement, I think that the actual conduct of the administration has absolutely been in good faith, but not just in good faith, but active incorporation of progressive legislation. And also for those of us individually, you know, I can at least say that there has been a lot of openness and willingness and flexibility in incorporating many of our goals, requests, demands, et cetera. And I think that it has been to the benefit of the country.
Yeah, you know, Danky, I kind of wanted your thoughts because, you know, like before we went into the video, you know, you made the comment, if, you know, how could you expect these, like the Justice Dems or the progressives to actually come in and change anything? You know, I guess I wonder what you think, because, you know, sitting here thinking that seeing this video, I do think of something that they could do. Maybe not. I don't have any dreams of them actually reforming the Democratic Party, but, you know, I do think that there could be like progressive type politicians who could come in who could expose the Democratic Party at the very least and not be afraid to call out the leadership in certain areas. You know, like you're not going to have, that's not going to be a transition to socialism in any regard. Like, I think it is important to keep in mind, you know, even in the first international, they talked about the small changes that they wanted to advocate for as far as just like reducing the working hours,
yeah,
larger changes. So I think it is good to keep like those two things separated and make sure we know which one we're focusing on when we're critiquing or advocating for something. But I don't know, I guess I wonder your response. Like, do you think that the Democrats could have a way of like at least exposing the party to show like, look, we tried, guys, but man, they sure didn't do anything.
I mean, at this point, like AOC has made promises. She's failed to stand up for the American worker time and time again. She failed to stand up for Medicare for all. She caved to the Democratic establishment. She caved to the Democratic establishment when it comes for a march for $15 minimum wage. And right now she is essentially saying to the left, gaslighting them, saying, oh no, you can trust President Biden. We all know that he is a conservative. As she said, we knew that he had conservative leanings, or many of us suspected he would have conservative leanings. Well, it turns out if you're not a sellout, you can clearly see that's the case. Joe Biden is a Republican in Democrats' clothes. That's all he is. And so for AOC to say, oh, guys, we're getting so much done, racism is going to be solved and the class struggle is going to be solved and we are getting our progressive agenda pushed through. I mean, literally anybody with two brain cells can say, hey, guys, systemic racism is bad, or sexism is bad. We need to be more tolerant. That's all that Joe Biden's done. It's all a bunch of words. He's not going to do anything substantial to address the problems of systemic racism, just like Alexandria Cortez isn't going to do anything substantial to address the problems of systemic racism. It's sad, but if Alexandria Cortez can show you anything, it's that you can take an average Joe working class individual and put them into political power under a dictatorship of the bourgeois, and she becomes bourgeois in her political leanings. She doesn't proletarianize the Democratic Party. It's not going to happen.
Right. And I guess what's so interesting about it, too, is that she even ran on putting political pressure on the Democratic Party leaders. So, like, what I'm describing as, you know, seeing any type of change in the party, or at least exposing them to people, you know, it's, I guess what's clear from this is it's not going to be AOC, because she's doing the exact opposite. Instead of saying, using her leverage to criticize, she's saying, oh, well, this is actually so great. So she's placating the left, you know, instead of putting pressure on the right-wing elements, which is the overwhelming majority of the Democratic Party, instead of like putting pressure on them, you know, she's placating the left. So like, you know, if right. if progressives can come in and change it or not, you know, I would say that I think that it is possible, but I think that they would have to come in almost like with a saboteur's mindset. Like, I don't think they could come in with any fantasies of, well, maybe these people might listen to me. So I think like it would have to be a highly dedicated individual who knew what they're getting themselves into. And I don't see any hopes of that with the characters we have thus far. So that's interesting to see. But I just want to say, it's also interesting that I don't remember the interview. I think it just happened recently. But Noam Chomsky apparently agrees with AOC on this.
He didn't use. He does.
Yeah, he didn't use as strong words. He didn't say she's just like he's just so like far left and all this or whatever. But he was saying that he's surprised all the stuff that Biden's doing, which I was surprised he said that because a lot of us suspected that Biden maybe in his first 100 days would put out a lot and try and do a lot in the beginning and then like maybe just kind of just chill after that. But I mean, like even then, I mean, what can you say he's done? I mean, that's a whole topic within itself. But right. I mean,
oh, I was just going to say, like, Obama made a lot of promises. His whole platform was change. And what change actually happened during Obama? He changed the frequency of drone strikes. That was the change that he came with. So, I mean, Chomsky selling out just like AOC sells out, it's not surprising. It's very easy for Granddaddy Chomsky to, you know, get interviewed and to ultimately wind up agreeing with the CIA on more issues than he disagrees with. And as sad as that is to say, you know, and I take this as someone who was like a former fan of Noam Chomsky before I became a Marxist-Leninist. And, you know, it's like hindsight being 2020, you can see that he has this clear anti-communist bias throughout his criticisms. He ultimately, when the USSR was dissolved, he said it was a victory for global communism. And anyone who was a true communist, anyone who had like a modicum of understanding for the communist movement understands that that's an absolutely asinine thing to say. But going back to AOC, you know, this is a person who I consider to be one of the most insidious politicians in America right now, because she goes around calling herself a socialist, a democratic socialist, but meanwhile, she is essentially kissing ass to the democratic establishment. She's kissing ass to Joe Biden. She did the same thing to Nancy Pelosi. She calls her mama bear, which is cringy to me. That's extremely cringy. And so to expect any sort of reform from within the Democratic Party at this point, even if you took the best, most class conscious politician and you put them in there, it would be like spraying a single drop of disinfectant on a public bathroom wall after a music festival or something. It's not going to work out. It's going to be engulfed by the bacteria. It's going to be engulfed by the slime of the bourgeois establishment.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, I mean, like, what has Biden done in this time? I mean, the main things that he can point to is he would say, I'm pulling troops out of Afghanistan. He'll say that he's ending the war. And he would say, well, the Dakota Access Pipeline, I got rid of that. But I mean, those are just so individual of two problems. You know what I mean? Like, you're not saying here's a sweeping thing that we're going to, an act that we're going to institute against a lot of pipelines. You know, it's just this one thing.
Right.
And like, you know, and as far as the Afghanistan war, a lot of us know there's been more coverage of this, but it's largely being privatized. We're going to have contractors there. There's still going to be CIA on the ground, which is very important. And, you know, they're actually looking at like I've been seeing reports where they're looking at like other areas where they're like, well, now that we don't have these troops here, you know, where else, you know, might we be able to put these people? So, I mean, we'll see where this goes, but they're not long standing problem solvers that he's instituting so far.
Do you think that the ultimate goal of the United States for countries like Afghanistan is just to turn them into a permanent chaos zone where they can get to the point where it's multiple private armies being hired by the same government basically to kill each other all for profit for the, you know, arms manufacturing companies and for the defense industry? And I can see the U.S. having a vested interest keeping countries like Afghanistan permanently at war, because that would just lead towards less development along Xinjiang and along Pakistan and those kind of regions, which would threaten U.S. hegemony.
Yeah, I think what you're asking is like, and this is a big question. I really can't say I have the answer totally to it, but is like looking specifically, not like all these wars, but specifically Afghanistan in that region in general, is it like a witch's brew that kind of got out of control? You know, were they just trying to control things in the area? And they're like, well, we can maybe put some markets in there one day, but it just got too chaotic and it just never ended. Or is it a very controlled chaos where they want to keep it chaotic, and so they can hopefully destabilize or keep other governments from maybe like getting access to very vital passages to get to oil and such. So I really don't have the answer to that. What do you think about that, Danky? I would say, if I had to guess, I would say, you know, in that center of the world, I would lean towards that they want to keep it chaotic, you know?
Right, especially if it's being contracted out to like private mercenary companies like Blackwater. I mean, obviously they wouldn't want the country to end the war. They wouldn't want the country to turn peaceful, because that cuts into their profits. And so I feel like we're going to see the commodification of war, not really on a major scale, but just on a small scale from country to country. And I feel like the United States is going to sort of blueprint all of this in Afghanistan and use Afghanistan as a testing ground, because after all, like, we've been there for two decades now, and our strategy in general is that we're pulling out, and we want to have the semblance of pulling out, but we still want to maintain a certain amount of control and a certain amount of like chaos in the region. And I think the biggest fear for the United States government is that if we pull out of Afghanistan, it's going to stabilize. And it's going to stabilize in favor of China or our other geopolitical rivals instead of us. And so They would rather just contract it out to Blackwater and say, all right, you guys go kill other human beings for profit. You know, have fun. We'll pretend like that's not what the U.S. government has been doing for the past two decades over there. But
yeah, I think that you're totally right on that. And, you know, so, yeah, I think we, you know, established Biden. Obviously, he's continuing the imperialist agenda, which are longstanding, techniques that they've been applying. And, you know, I just want to finish this out. The last clip I want to play, you know, somebody who actually agrees a little bit with Noam Chomsky and AOC there is I believe he's a senator. Let's pull up the video here so I can see this guy's name. Okay, so yeah, this is Senator John Kennedy. He's on Tucker Carlson's show. So yeah, let's see what he has to say about Biden's term thus far.
But the wokeristas, like the congresswoman, they really believe that. They really do hate cops just because they're cops. They really do want to defund the police, which will result in a fantastic impression of hell. The wokeristas really do believe that when a cop shoots a criminal, it is always, every single time, the cop's fault. But when a criminal shoots a cop, it is always, every single time, the gun's fault. These folks really do have contempt for America. They should have gratitude, but they have contempt. And they're not happy, and won't be happy, until they take a sledgehammer to America's core. Now, you're saying to yourself, probably, look, this is America. You're entitled to believe what you want. And I agree with that. And I have hope for them. Jellyfish have survived 650 million years without a brain. So there is hope for them. But what I'm disappointed in is President Biden. He has encouraged this. I listened to him last night, and he knows better. No one can get to be his age with his experience and not know this is nonsense. And I hear people say all the time, you know, cut him some slack, maybe he's lost his fastball. No, he knows better. And he's encouraged it. and it is a hurting America, and it is hurting people. And I knew that President Biden would be left of center. I never dreamed he'd be left of Lenin. And he needs to stand up. Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so that's hilarious. So apparently, yeah, Noam Chomsky, and not just AOC, but you know, apparently he agrees that Biden is not only left of center, but he's left of Lenin. So I guess he's more closer to a Stalin type figure in their eyes than he is even Lenin. How about that?
Yeah, like once again, this is these Republicans having absolutely zero idea what communism is or what socialism is. They don't even know what liberalism is. Like the thing that they claim to like hate so much, they don't even know what they're talking about. It's embarrassing. Like I hear stuff like that and I cringe because it's so embarrassing. His cop apology, it might as well just be fascist apologia, because he put you in a no-win situation when he said, oh, what, they think every time a cop shoots a criminal, it's the cop's fault. Like, our complaint is that these people who are victims of police brutality are being branded as criminals before they've even had their day in court, and they're being shot by the cops. So already it sort of presupposes, he sort of like gave up the racist ghost there, because he just presupposes that like every time a person of color is shot by cops, they're doing some kind of criminal act, or they're behaving like a criminal.
Right,
It's ridiculous. Like the thinly veiled white supremacy on Tucker Carlson's show is so thinly veiled that, you know, you can see through it. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's so transparent. It's so transparently racist to anyone with a brain who watches it objectively. And I don't know where they dug that guy up, what kind of crypt they had to bust into to find him. But we need senators in our government that were born in this century. And I don't know. Like, oh my God, dude. Seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, that, of course, it, you know, like on one hand, it's just obviously ridiculous and it's totally silly. But, you know, there's kind of two narratives going on here. On one hand, there is the Republicans who have been saying since the debates, they've been saying, wow, this guy is so far left. He likes the Green New Deal. He's a socialist. And, you know, CNN, all these people have been kind of just trying to laugh it off, you know, and their narrative, the Democrat folks, they are saying, well, Biden's for unity. And he's actually going to be the one to reach across the aisle. And you guys are wrong. And he's going to prove you wrong that he's not a socialist, because he's just going to have so many good deals with you. Just wait and see. But it's funny because, you know, now they're saying like, oh, they don't want to work with us at all. Biden's just passing all these far left, you know, deals without our help and everything. Ultimately, I think like it's kind of fueling the Republicans' narrative that Biden's this far left socialist. If you have people like AOC out there saying, oh, look how much Biden works with progressives. Then it makes, if somebody saw that clip we watched of AOC and then saw that senator, they would say, well, she's the socialist person, right? So it's from coming right from her mouth. So this senator must be right.
And that's why politicians like AOC are so insidious, because they brand socialism in such a way that it favors the bourgeois establishment. And it's like co-opting and gaslighting revolutionary language, revolutionary symbolism for the ultimate gain of capitalists. There's nothing more sinister than that. Anyone who is trying to say voting blue will change things, voting blue will help the class situation in the United States, doesn't understand that the war isn't between red and blue. The war is between the rich and the poor.
Right. And yeah, I mean, for AOC, I mean, talk about her use of the term socialism. Why I think it's so damaging is because basically when you make comments like this, you're dragging the name of socialism through the name, or through the, you're dragging the name of socialism through the mud. If right. you're making these kind of comments and misrepresenting what socialism actually is.
Right. But I do think if on the campaign trail, you did have someone who was like, yeah, I'm a communist. What are you going to do about it? You gonna cry? And you know, they were just real upfront about it, and they were just overtly challenging these politicians, especially like AOC, right to their face, and pointing out how shallow and how hollow they really are. I feel like it would be entertaining to watch, and it would probably lead towards a lot more people waking up and realizing, oh yeah, voting probably isn't going to solve our problems.
Yeah, right. That's my biggest, that's the thing. That's the biggest win you could get. I think, you know, it's not like you change the system, but maybe people would realize that the system can't be changed.
Right. You challenge it right to its face. There's nothing wrong with doing that. There's nothing sellout about doing that. But the fun thing about these like social democrat politicians is that they're all a bunch of phonies, because they want to say, oh, I'm so revolutionary. My name's Bernie Sanders and I'm a revolutionary, everyone. Meanwhile, I'm going to vote for the defense budget of the United States government to do imperialism overseas. And I'm going to sell out and bend the knee to Hillary Clinton and to Joe Biden. It's insulting. It's like, do you really expect us to swallow this bullshit?
It really is. And of course, this is, you know, we're getting to see what the, call them what you will, you know, the squad, the Justice Democrats, you know, we're seeing how they've operated thus far, pretty much. But yeah, I think that's going to pretty much do it for today's show. We're still working on our third episode of our Moscow Trials series. Hopefully that will be up sometime early next month, I'm hoping. But yeah, we're still chugging away at that. So yeah, we appreciate everybody still listening in and everything. Give us your suggestions or comments, what you thought about, like, you know, the debates that we brought up today, you know, what you think about all that.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in, and stay tuned for the next episode.